I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Our guests, Cora Daniels and John L. Jackson Jr., are challenging the notion that some topics are so explosive and so controversial that they should not be discussed in polite company. They are co-authors of a book called Impolite Conversations on Race, Politics, Sex, Money, and Religion. And that covers just about everything. They share their wide-ranging opinions and a bit about their personal lives in their book, and they invite readers to do the same. Cora Daniels and John L. Jackson Jr. have known each other since they were in high school in Brooklyn, and they join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Cora Daniels is also the author of a book called Ghetto Nation and Black Power Incorporated. She's currently a contributing writer for Essence. And Cora Daniels, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. John L. Jackson is a cultural anthropologist and filmmaker, dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania, author of four books, including four other books, I should add, Harlem World, Real Black, Racial Paranoia, and Thin Description. And John L. Jackson, Jr., nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marnie.
To you, John, any impolite conversations over the Thanksgiving holiday that you engaged in?
All the time. I mean, Thanksgiving is a I think Thanksgiving is good for two things, showing gratitude, but also finally getting people together you haven't seen in a while and talking with them seriously about what they've been doing for the past year that you don't approve of. So we did a little bit of that, but we had a great time.
And how about for you, Cora?
Yeah, pretty much the same. There was a lot of awkward pauses.
Awkward pauses, which is kind of a substitute for an impolite conversation.
Exactly.
Why did you want to write this book, John?
For a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, first and foremost, I do feel like one of the things that I find most troubling is we spend so much time talking about needing to talk, and I feel like we have such few skills at actually doing it effectively. And so it was really just our attempt to say, well, what would we want to imagine we'd say in mixed company that we maybe don't feel comfortable saying, but do it in a way that demonstrates a kind of good faith commitment to actually communicating something and to also listening. So what we want the book to be is in some ways a demonstration of us having listened to other people who've talked to us about what their concerns are, but also an opportunity to just lay out there for folks things we know people are thinking about,
yeah,
but often they're too shy or afraid to venture into the public with it in a way that they know might get blowback. And so I think it was just good for us to try to demonstrate that in some way.
Well, I think it's interesting that you went to high school together and have remained friends. I mean, is there something about your relationship that you think allows, Cora, the two of you to be maybe more honest with each other than you are with other friends, for instance?
Well, I think because of that long history, there's a rapport there and there's an honesty, and we feel comfortable enough to be candid. And I think that comes through in the book. It's not just an academic and a journalist who just met and like
right.
are discussing these.
Right.
You know, we have like a history, so we've known each other before we were, you know, the grown-up academic and journalist.
And I learned so much about Cora reading her essays.
Well, I've learned a lot about the two of you, actually.
So even people who you feel like you're relatively intimate with, you realize there's so much you just don't talk about. You don't have time and space to really. So for us, it was also an attempt to say, well, either we're going to do this because we've been threatening to write something together since we were in high school just about, or we're not. And if we're going to do it, let's do it in a way that's going to allow us to both, you know, show that we're interested in research, evidence, data, but also talking about this stuff in the way that shows our own personal stakes in it, our own investments.
You know, I'm thinking probably some people listening to us to say, oh, people have impolite conversations all the time. I mean, read blogs, follow some Twitter fight back and forth. But what you're calling for or asking for is something different. What is it that you want people to do, Cora?
Well, we want people to actually have a little more depth in that dialogue and not and also listen. So when you're you know, ranting on Twitter or in blogs and stuff, you're talking, you know, by yourself basically, because it doesn't really matter, you know, if people agree or not. And part of, I mean, John came up with the great line, but part of what we're challenging people is not only to talk, but challenging them to listen and to really, like, have that discussion.
In fact, the two of you have said listen about four times. We're about five or six minutes into the interview.
We have our story down. You know, the other thing, too, I will just put a finer point on this. It comes up in the book as well. I think it's easy to pretend you can have a substantive conversation with someone you don't know or care about. So the other thing we're modeling in the book is serious discussions with people you have a vested interest in continuing a relationship with. So the web doesn't quite count because we have anonymity. We can do all these crazy things under the cover or cloak of anonymity right. that we wouldn't do, right, if people either knew our identities or if it was in the bright light of day. So part of, I think, what we're trying to also demonstrate is that it's not just enough to say we need to talk. We need to talk in a way that shows an investment that extends beyond the dialogue into building a community. And a community that's going to outlast the simple discussion that takes place in any one period of time.
Right. But you're really talking about person to person. In many ways, it's sort of an analog approach to conversation, right, Cora?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things also that we were trying to bring out is, you know, in our professional life, we don't, you know, as an academic and a journalist, we can sort of hide behind like the research and the reporting, and we really got personal in the book. Not that it's a memoir at all, but we felt if we were going to have these honest conversations, then we had to be honest about stuff that was going on in our own lives, and we had to also be honest about, I knew I was going to write stuff that might offend John or what he was doing, and he did the same, knowing that there was stuff that I wasn't going to agree with. So it's not a he said she said, but it's you know, this honest journey.
And the key to, Marty, is what we believe isn't about what we can rationally justify and explain. It isn't about the evidence. It's about our gut. And so a lot of that stuff is formed simply as a function of a biography. So telling people who you are helps them to understand why you interpret things the way you do and the kind of voice you have.
And that was just a different space for, I mean, as a journalist, you know, always putting my life out there a little bit was very different for me, and same with John as an, you know, this is not one of his academic books where, you know, everything is cited there, you know.
Well, I want to pick up on all of that, but let me just go back to you, John, about your comment that we keep having conversations about having conversations. What are we afraid of? I mean, what is it that prevents the kind of real dialogue and conversation that the two of you were talking about?
That's a good question. I don't have a great answer for it, except to say I think we make a fetish out of the idea of conversation. So the conversation isn't the end. It's a means to another end, right? So that other end is what we're trying to get at. So we're talking, trying to find a way to operationalize a solution that's going to be better for everyone in the world. And I think often we want to imagine that the point is simply to talk. And if that's what we think, I think we're setting ourselves up to fail. Mm-hmm. It's to give ourselves a discussion that lays the groundwork for changing or transforming our social lives.
Because that's really where creativity and innovation comes from. If you feel in this safe place where you can honestly say whatever it is you want to say without feeling that you're going to be attacked by whatever the repercussions are, you know, that's where you then move on and get to sort of you know, some innovative thinking about whatever the issue is.
Well, let me go back to you, Cora. In the section about sex, you write, I enjoy sex. Let's just put it out there, right?
Well, yes. I mean, I felt in that chapter I was trying to talk about how we teach our daughters about sex. And you know, I say this as a mother of my daughter actually just turned 9 on Thanksgiving.
Oh. So, well, congratulations. Happy birthday to her.
So, you know, and we talk to our little girls differently than we talk to our little boys or talk to children in general. And you know, often we don't sort of teach our daughters that sex is okay, that it's something that they can enjoy and something that they should enjoy. It doesn't mean that they're enjoying it at 9, you know, but as they become an adult and they have a healthy adult, mature relationship, sex is going to be a part of that no matter who their partner is. And in that chapter, I really wanted to talk about the truest way to enjoy sex is by respecting your partner and respecting yourself. And so why wouldn't we teach that to our little girls?
Did that feel like a risky thing? I mean, those three words, I enjoy
sex.
Oh,
yeah. That was yes. that was the only chapter where I really, really thought about, like, my mom is going to read this.
I was just going to say, I don't know anything about your family. And did she read it? And what did she
say?
Yes,
she did. She did read it. And I was very, very nervous as she's reading, because I did not come. You know, it's also a little easier for me as an adult to think about how I want to raise my children or you know, come up with these ideas of how we should raise our children. Doesn't mean I was raised that way. Mm-hmm. And not to criticize my own household, but
sure.
I was definitely raised in a much more traditional household where sex was not talked about at all. And so for me, even to write those words, I enjoy sex, was revolutionary.
And did it feel good, though, to put it on paper?
I can tell you too, Marty. I was surprised how much of a reactionary backlash. Out of all the stuff in the book that we write about Obama and race, it's that chapter about young girls and sexuality that Cora's gotten the most hammered on online vis-a-vis the anonymous bloggers. Right?
It's because we're scared of empowered women. And part of, you know, when you enjoy sex, you become an empowered woman. And I think that concept is really difficult for people so they want to twist it. They want to think I'm saying something else. And it's very easy to sort of jump down that realm.
Well, there's just three words. I enjoy sex, right? Well, but let me go to you, John, because you have a chapter called There's a Conspiracy to Hyper-Masculinize Black Boys. And you talk about your stepfather giving you a bit of a sex talk about, you know, essentially don't be gay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, part of what I want to do in that chapter is just to try to explain to people how it is we can connect questions of police brutality, say, and representations of black masculinity linked to Trayvon Martin and what's going on in Ferguson right now and everything else, to the intimacies of a father trying to teach his son what it means to be a man. And we have all of these preconceived notions about what manhood is. And I think my stepdad did the best job he could trying to impart to me his own sense of what it meant to be a man in the contemporary society. It was predicated, at least in part, on this really severe commitment to policing the line between homosexuality and heterosexuality. And for him, that was the big takeaway.
But it sounds like what you're saying is perhaps there is a connection between, as you say, but part of my point is that there might be a link between this demonization of homosexuality and the social vulnerability of black boys and men. Since we don't want queers, we overcompensate by creating the would-be thugs.
Yeah. Well, I'm an anthropologist, which means part of my job is to think about the connective tissue between and among every aspect of our cultural landscape. And so I want to say, what would it mean to think about how we draw a line between our assumptions about what black manhood looks like within our community and the way those assumptions get lampooned and further demonized by folks outside of the community. And so if you're really invested in a particular performance of masculinity, you might feel comfortable within your community what that means and how. But for folks who already are threatened, say, by outsiders who don't have the expectation that they can trust or understand people from a different social world, those performances get read in a much less generous way. Hmm. And it means it's much more likely that the very same kind of performance, if it was done by someone who looked like, you know, George Zimmerman, would be read differently than it would be read from across the racial lines. And that's part of the point. To say, like, all the stuff we assume about the world, people are then reading, and they're not often reading it in the ways in which we would. Their interpretive lens might be different.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are, in fact, talking about impolite conversations on race, politics, sex, money, and religion. Our guests are the co-authors of the book, Cora Daniels and John L. Jackson, Jr. We'll take a very short break and get back to our conversation. We've touched on some very interesting issues, so let me open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about impolite conversations, and we want your comments. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. If you're just joining us, Cora Daniels and John L. Jackson are our guests, authors of Impolite Conversations on Race, Politics, Sex, Money, and Religion. Cora Daniels is a contributing writer for Essence, and John L. Jackson is the dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania, and they have known each other since they were in high school together in Brooklyn. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Cora, let me go back to you and even the chapter where you write about sex, and you say, and I'm quoting here, black women have allowed the church to shape our sex lives. And I'd like to have you just explain what you mean there.
Well, there's a whole conversation about the declining rates of marriage. And when you break those down, it's really it really has to do with class. And so the when you look at professional women, there's no declining rates of marriage, except for when you look at black women. So there's black professional women tend to marry less. And so they're breaking trend. And so I was trying to look at that to see, well, why are they breaking trend? And when you look at that subset of women, the difference is the church, that those are women who are much more vested in the church compared to their counterparts in other races. And so, you know, to me, that was a sign that that we were allowing the church to sort of shape our relationships, pouring ourselves into the church rather than sort of exploring relationships. And it was sort of shaping our sexuality more than maybe we were willing to admit.
Because the church has rules about what you can and can't do or what you should or shouldn't do.
Right. And also it changes your expectations. If you're
It's complicated.
It is complicated. If you're sort of married to the teachings in such a strict interpretation, that which, you know, is showing up in that professional in black professional women more than, you know, if you're looking at class more than others, it has that their relationships, their sexual relationships are not as honest as they could be, because you often feel like you're doing something wrong.
Oh,
you know, this is something not that good church-going women do.
John, you have a chapter in the book, Are Black People Still Over-Churched? What do you mean?
Well, I think in some ways, maybe it pivots on a similar point that Cora was just making. And the good thing about the book also is we don't agree on a lot of stuff, right? So we have a very different history of engagements with organized religion. I come out of Seventh-day Adventism. We were really intensely in Seventh-day Adventism growing up in Brooklyn, New York. And I guess part of the point has always been to think about what the role of the church is. So there was a set of assumptions that said, well, the church is this space, and, you know, Karl Marx is on the most famous articulant of this particular position, that in some ways allows people to disengage from the real on-the-ground political work that has to be done because they're vying for a space in some world that's going to come by later. So it depoliticizes, which is one version of an argument. But part of what we saw, especially with the civil rights movement, was the clear politicization of the church and organized religion as part of what I think was the engine that spurred on the civil rights advancements. And so part of the point is simply to say, what is the contemporary role of organized religion in political life across racial lines, but also in terms of people's most intimate investments in their social networks. And I want to argue that we should just be thinking about what, because the role isn't going to be the same now as it was 10 years ago or 100 years ago. And it's our responsibility to, as purposefully and self-consciously as we can, to think about what we're doing with these institutions and how we're deploying them to make our worlds better.
So what do you two really disagree on? You really disagree on an issue. Is there something?
I think there are. I mean, so Cora has this great piece on education and the role of education she always brings up. And so in some ways, the takeaway of her piece, I think, is, well, maybe not everyone needs to go to college.
Right.
And, you know, my position is I think everyone could go to college. Right. I think and there are a whole bunch of reasons why I understand where she's coming from and what her point is. But I still would defend the idea that we need to have a level playing field. That means everyone should imagine that as an option and possibility, that no one should be disqualified from that guild. And so it's stuff like that. But in every domain, I think we would have versions of those debates, sometimes about big ticket issues, sometimes about the details.
Yeah, because I think that was the essay that I wrote that was the most, you know, personal worrisome for John. I think the one that he wrote was the essay about jazz, which, you know, to me was, you know, just had to do with my own personal background. And
it was like
and
a personal things. Attack.
It did. It did. It's caused major family feuds in my family.
Like, how could you be friends with this guy?
Exactly.
So I start that chapter by saying, mostly to be overly provocative, yes, I hate jazz music.
I know. I saw that as well.
And for a whole bunch of reasons, I argue. But Cora's family, I mean, jazz is in their DNA. I mean, that's what they've always done. I've known this since Cora was in high school. And so I realized those are kind of fighting words to Cora. And so in a big scheme of things, you go, why would that even count or fit in a book like this one? It fits because this is really a touchy issue for us to be discussing the way we're trying to do it.
Yeah, you're nodding your head, Cora.
Yeah, no, it's just funny. And it's interesting because those were the first two essays we wrote, too. Those were the two essays that got us the book deal. We, like, submitted those two essays, and it was just like those were the most personal.
And, of course, just to be clear, my problem with jazz isn't with the music. I mean, I love jazz music in an aesthetic sense and
no,
virtuosity.
You don't.
I do.
Go for it. We want to hear this.
But it's sort of more how jazz gets used, right? So jazz becomes part of weaponry, I argue, in this class warfare between black middle class respectability and the black quote unquote underclass that don't have the cachet to deploy jazz in the same way. And so that's what I don't like about it, that people can use jazz as one of the tools to separate us, right, the cultured, from them, the mere hip hop folks or something like that.
Well, I think this is the quote you're referring to, and I'm quoting you, John. Jazz is a black middle class response to the threat of racial inauthenticity, a trump card rejoinder to the equally problematic assumption that urban poverty is the only thing that legitimately comprises African American social realities.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of ways in which black communities are trying to figure out, and this isn't just exclusive to black communities at all, this is a universal problem, is what is the most authentic version of who and what we are?
Right.
And who determines that?
But you also go on in this chapter, page after page, on Treme, which, you know, I mean, a show I will miss forever. Cora, anything you want to add to that?
No, it's just...
He's wrong.
I love Treme. I talk about Treme and how it doesn't fit that model, right? It doesn't fit that model. It's a grittier jazz, right? It's a jazz of the people. It's down in the Treme. That's part of the point. It's not up in some rarefied space in Lincoln Center, right? It's down in the trenches, and that's different.
Now, for me, it was just... I was surprised how personal I took that essay. You know, I mean, so I'm not a jazz musician. My brother's a jazz musician. My father's steeped in jazz. But, you know, I've never earned a dime. I don't even read music. but you know, reading John's essay, you know, I did feel this protective, yeah. this on a very personal level. And it was one of the essays that did want me to sort of, you know, have what we were trying not to have, like, people argue and yell and stuff. And that was, like, one of those essays where, you know, I was like, are you kidding me? Are you crazy? Like, you know, I wanted to basically do what we were trying not to do and have these deep, and it was all sort of emotional for me.
Although I will say a concession I've made is that we have a web series online, and the opening for the web series is a jazz tune composed by her brother.
Oh, how good is that? Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Cora Daniels and John L. Jackson are our guests in this hour of Radio Times, authors of a new book called Impolite Conversations on Race, Politics, Sex, Money, and Religion, and apparently jazz as well. John L. Jackson Jr. is the Dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. Cora Daniels is a contributing writer for Essence, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We're getting comments at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, and we'd be curious about what constitutes an impolite conversation in your world. We have a comment from Charlotte in West Grove. Do they think a white person could have written the book that they have? Would it be too racially charged, especially with some of the valuations of the community that they have done? You're sort of half nodding your head, John.
Well, I mean, I think we all need to be much more courageous and fearless about the things we write, but also respectful. So I think the key is recognizing what is your end goal. If the only thing you're trying to do is fan flames and provoke people just for the sake of gnashing of teeth, then I don't think that's constructive. But if you're actually trying to reach someone with a different perspective, ideological position, from a different walk of life, and you're doing it sincerely but telling them what you feel, mm-hmm. I think anyone can operate in that sphere and do it productively.
When we were thinking about the book also, I mean, it was interesting that the caller posed the question of the writer, you know, because we were all, you know, you often think of the reader, because we always thought, like, that we wanted to challenge the reader to cross race lines and class lines and gender lines and whatever other lines are they box themselves in, because too often these conversations are, if they are happening at all, are with people that look just like you.
For fear that you might offend somebody. Or say something wrong.
Right. And
somehow.
So you know, when I was thinking of the book also, you know, like when people would ask you, oh, what are you writing about? And I said, this book, Impolite Conversations. And they're like, what do you want? And I was like, well, we're trying to challenge people to get out of their comfort zone. And, you know, that was not that I'm a marketer at all, because obviously because I'm a journalist. So that was like, you know, the tagline that didn't catch on anywhere. But that was what I was.
Which is why you're a journalist.
Which is why I'm a journalist. But
And you will offend someone. I think you have to embrace the fact that you will unequivocally offend someone if you're speaking honestly, if you're speaking to people who don't share the same history you do. But the key is to try to figure out what happens at that moment and how constructively do you negotiate that and learn from it and do it in a way that's going to allow both of you all and other people to grow.
You described, John, you were in a tow truck with a guy, your car had broken down, and having a conversation. And eventually he said, those damn Mexicans.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I think for me, that is a really good example of the fact that not all forms of sort of post-racial community are created equal.
Yeah.
That one of the ways in which we build common links across difference is by scapegoating third and fourth parties.
So what did you say, though? I mean, what do you say when someone said something that maybe offends you?
It depends on the context. So again, I'm trained as an anthropologist, which means, you know, I suffer fools, as they say. So I want to hear what people believe. And my job isn't to change their opinion right there. My job is to figure out how they really can believe that, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things I tell my students is I'm most fascinated by folks who share the same history with me, breathe the same air, live in the same community, and believe things diametrically opposed to what I believe. I want to know how they got there.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I want to feel like if my positions are strong and valid, I should be able to convince them that they can reimagine theirs, but they can get me to reconsider mine, too. And that's also part of what should be open to debate and up for discussion. So in that moment, it depends there. In that moment, I wanted to get him to figure out exactly what were Mexicans standing in for? What was the real fear there? What did they represent for him?
Do you want to add to that, Cora? I mean, have you had some version of that? I guess we all have, right?
Yeah, I think we all have. I mean, I thought when I was reading that essay, I was just I was impressed with the level of honesty that John was, you know, at that moment, because I think those are some moments that, if we're really honest, like, all of us have had moments like this and we just don't admit them. I think the biggest reaction, even if you're not a trained anthropologist, is to sit there quietly. Most people do just sit there quietly if they're confronted with sort of, overt, not that there can be overt racism. Racism doesn't need to be overt. It's just being. But I think that to see that, to read that on the page, sort of reminds all of us just how sort of common and free flowing these moments are.
Well, I mean, this is not an advice book, but I mean, taking that, I mean, there are ways to engage on these I guess stereotypes, which is to say, I don't believe that.
Yeah. I mean, I think also when you question folks, I mean, you don't even have to say you don't believe it. Like, if you question them on why, then they start digging themselves into, and in engaging them. I think that also, which is because I think, if we say nothing, the other thing is also just to push back, to say like, oh, you're wrong. And you know, when if you just start from the point where it's obvious you're wrong, like if you're starting a conversation with those damn Mexicans or those damn women or those damn blacks or whoever it is you're filling in for that moment, then obviously that person is wrong.
Although my premise is also you could be right. Right. But you're going to have to prove to me that you're right.
Right. So, but that's how you engage
exactly,
them. You then ask them like, well, why?
This is where the listening comes in.
I think that's true. And listening very carefully. And we're irrational enough creatures. We are irrational enough that we deconstruct ourselves. You get people to talk enough about what they believe and why, you realize that there's no ground to stand on for most of it, because it's something we feel, because that's what our parents taught us. And so just getting people to own that part of it, to realize there's no evidentiary ground they're standing on, they just believe it. To get them to at least get there, I think begins to open up the possibility they might reconsider ways of understanding their place in the world.
Let me read some more comments. This is from Paul. Nice topic today, especially in the wake of Ferguson. I'm lucky I have a multi-ethnic group of friends that I can discuss these matters with in a thoughtful way. Very lucky, ! I think the discussion parameters depend a lot on the relationship parameters. I mean, clearly you two are good longtime friends and where you can probably feel safe with each other, knowing you might say something that would anger the other person. Cora?
Yeah, I think there is a comfort level there. But I think also when you are such good friends with someone, then there's like the other avenue where you don't want to sort of push that friendship over the cliff. You don't want to sort of offend them too much. So I think we fool ourselves thinking that there is this comfort level because there's friends. I think there's a comfort level where you feel like you can be yourself, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you actually can speak as yourself.
There's the other problem, though, which is that you just have friends that you agree with, right? I mean, that often happens, right?
That's absolutely true. I mean, in some ways, you wouldn't hang out with folks if you're going to fight with them all the time.
Right, exactly.
I think one of my students, I think, put it very well. in the School of Social Policy and Practice by saying what we really need ultimately is to produce spaces that are safe for people with different perspectives to feel uncomfortable. So the idea is sometimes we want to feel comfortable, and that's different from being safe. So you can be comfortable, and then people are unsafe everywhere in the conversation, or everyone can be safe enough that we can feel a little bit of discomfort. And I think that's the key. And so sometimes you feel safe enough with people you know and care about to ask uncomfortable questions, right? Mm. But you have to be able and willing to do it.
We have a tweet from Janine. Awesome topic. Any advice for how to grow the conversation and not just engage the person you're talking to? As I said, this is not an advice book, but you're asking people to do things that they might not feel comfortable for doing.
Go ahead, Cora. Yeah, Cora.
So you give me the hard question. Well, I mean, I think the first step is to engage. And I think when you get to that sort of space that John was just talking about, where you feel safe to be uncomfortable, the next step is to then challenge, because that's how you sort of grow the thinking and sort of move. I mean, I'm kind of coming to the point where I kind of feel like our thinking is stagnant at the moment, you know, because everyone is just yelling or everyone is just, you know, like. And we haven't moved forward. Everyone's just yelling the same thing. So, like, even the issue, the conversation with Ferguson that's going on at the moment, I feel like we have this conversation all the time, like every few years. And the sad part is that it keeps repeating itself. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, how do we move beyond the same conversation that we have every single time something explodes and to get to real sort of creative and innovative thought? And I think bringing up these topics – you know, wherever they may, bring them up with your children also, because that's you're raising a next generation, and not being sort of afraid to speak up, you know, wherever it may be.
That's Cora Daniels, also with us, John L. Jackson Jr. We are talking about their book. It's called Impolite Conversations on Race, Politics, Sex, Money, and Religion. And as I said, that covers just about everything. Taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Getting a lot of tweets at Marty Moscowen. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Cora Daniels and John L. Jackson Jr. How often do you get to have or have you had an honest person-to-person conversation about a contentious or divisive or even a taboo issue? And we're talking about how to have that conversation, the subject of their new book. And I should add, Cora Daniels is a journalist and John L. Jackson Jr. is an anthropologist. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. So let's put something else on the table here. And I'm looking at a chapter that you started, Cora. I can't say the first word, the N-word. Bring back the word nigger. Why do you want, and I feel, you know, I'm a white person here. Why should we bring back the word nigger?
Well, I feel that the N-word basically erases history. And it becomes then easier to say hateful speech because we have sort of this nickname for it. And if it's really such this terrible thing and it's really such this hateful thing, then we if you actually say the word, then it becomes harder and harder to say. And so we get out of those spaces where we feel the need to do it. So what happens is that since we have sort of this N-word nickname, is that we just use it more and more. So, you know, I'll be in newsrooms where it's like discussed endlessly, like should we do this or do that, or you'll be in classrooms where people, and you'll be in the most polite of spaces, you know, talking about the most hateful language. And there's no other word that's like that. You know, every other form of discourse, we're able to express ourselves without using that sort of language because we feel that it's inappropriate. Except for the word nigger.
So where do you stand on this word?
So part of what I try to argue in my piece, so I have a companion piece on there where I talk about, in a tongue-in-cheek way, trying to monetize
us
using the word nigger. So giving white people in America the opportunity to say it safely if they're willing to pay funds. And so that's about income. It's a joke. But part of the point is to say we should figure out how and why any term that we construct and concoct can have this kind of power over us? And what does that say about us? Because all it is language we've produced. There's nothing magical in the term itself. There's nothing about it intrinsically that should have this tormenting power. So why do we give it that power? And what does that power allow us to say and not say vis-a-vis the history of race and slavery in America? And so for me, it's about saying if we really put all our cards on the table, we have to recognize that the issue is that we don't really have a language for talking about racial empathy, but we do have a language that really distills in a very powerful way the history of our racial antipathies. And that's what that word represents.
Would it be also taking a page from gay rights or from gays and lesbians who use the word queer? I mean, in certain ways, sort of taking that word that has been used in a disparaging way and owning it. I mean, can you do that with the word
nigger?
I mean,
that's a debate in the black community right now. So there are tons of folks who say, you know, that's a word that we shouldn't talk about. To even deploy it is to operationalize a version of internalized racism. And other folks say, no, this is us reclaiming the term and using it in a much more affectionate way. And I think I can understand both arguments.
But are you saying, Cora, we should just use the word sort of willy-nilly every...
No, I don't think we should use the word. That's the point. I think when we have sort of the substitute, we do use it willy-nilly. And we sort of forget sort of the history of the word and the emotional hatred of the word.
And we drive it underground. So it's not like people aren't saying the word, right?
Right.
So they're saying it. They're not saying it in the bright light of day.
Right.
And so part of my point in the playful chapter is it might be much more therapeutic for us if the folks who want to say that word have a protective space wherein they can say it to the folks they're imagining they're impugning with the term.
They just have to put a little quarter in the jar, right?
Maybe a little more than a quarter, but yes. Yeah, something like that.
But also when we're talking about, the three of us here, we also sort of take for granted that we know what that word means. We know the history of that word. We know everything that comes behind that word. And when we're talking about sort of reclaiming language, it's easy for us to talk about that when the word is still fresh.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about, we've already brought up like our kids. If you think about like, my kids who are like 9 and 6 at the moment, what is their relationship to that word going to be if they grow up into a world where everything uses N-word instead of the actual word that we're replacing? And because my argument is it's not going to disappear just because we've now reclaimed it and called it N-word or called it nigga with an A. You know, what disappears then is people's real understanding of what that word means. And so then you'll have a whole generation who don't really have that connection, which is, I would argue, why a younger generation feels so empowered to sort of reclaim it because they don't.
And to use it, right?
To use it because they don't truly understand the history.
Let me get Karen to join our conversation. And Karen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I think I really disagree with you. When someone uses a racial or ethnic or homosexual slur when they're talking to me, I think they think I'm going to be okay with it. You know, that's why they're using it. They're comfortable. And I say, I don't want to hear that.
So if someone were to say...
I don't want to hear that.
Okay.
I want them to be nervous the next time they say this to someone.
Rather than sort of listening and trying to understand. Let me toss that back to you, John.
I don't think that's a bad position to take. I don't think I disagree with you. In some ways, it always depends on the specific situation. But you don't want people – I feel like I don't want people to feel comfortable around me saying all manner of craziness and disparaging things. Like you want to make sure people also realize you're going to be mindful of them respecting other people's identities and communities and histories.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to recognize that we don't always draw – we want to imagine the line is drawn clearly and self-evidently. But think about all the stuff with the NFL now and the Redskins name. There's some people who think that's just preposterous to have a debate about this. Like who cares about it? But – I understand why it is we have these very different perspectives on it. And the only way to get it is to recognize when and if something offends someone, even if you didn't anticipate it or don't understand why that would be the case, and trying to figure out how they got there. And maybe that'll allow you to change your perspective. You won't use it as much, or maybe you'll double down on it. But the point is at least to be cognizant of the fact that we're not all going to configure our sort of linguistic landscapes the exact same way.
And I think I'm actually a little closer to your caller because this is one of the points where John and I disagree. And I feel that you should always be uncomfortable, and that's why the N-word, using the N-word substitute is just as wrong, because people are comfortable using the N-word as the substitute rather than the word that it's really substituting for. And I feel that you should always be uncomfortable. You should always be uncomfortable using that hateful speech. So there shouldn't be this nickname for it that people can that we can say on the radio.
Well, and just to add a little personal story, someone said the N-word in front of my husband. This was years ago, and he said, don't use that word in front of me. I mean, I find that word offensive. And you know, wasn't like a lifelong, was mm-hmm. someone he had just literally mm-hmm. just met. But I'm saying there are ways to say, you cannot say that in front of me. You cannot do that.
You're right. And I think the key is to recognize when you're doing that in the spaces where there aren't folks who are being maligned in that room, right? So if it's at the dinner table, if it's in some space where the lodge group is meeting and no one else is there, like that's the moment where you have to say, you know what? Even in these spaces, we have to be we have to be credible communicators. And credibility comes with being consistent both in external situations, but also with the folks who you know most intimately.
Let me see what Ariel. Karen, thanks for the call. Ariel from Ardmore has to say. Ariel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Marty. Hi. Well, I came in 1999 as an international student to the University of Michigan and from Israel. And my mom said, when you come to the U.S., because she was living here for 4 years in the 60s, she said, well, you can't say three things to Americans. You can't talk to them about religion, money, or politics.
We covered half of those, yes.
Yes. And then I said, so what do you talk about? And she said, the weather. And I thought she was kidding. And then I went here to, like I said, the University of Michigan, and I went to the School of Social Work. And we had a conversation about, it was community organizing, and the issue of race came up. And none of the students agreed to say anything. And they were and especially the white students were saying, well, we're afraid to say anything because we're afraid that anything we'll say will be, you know, misconstrued, or that we'll insult somebody. And then I said, well, then how are you going to solve anything if you're not going to talk about anything?
Exactly.
And it was... You know, it still wasn't convincing enough. So.
Well, no, I hear you. And I'm glad you raised it because I think you called the right people, Ariel. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Cora, anything you want to say?
No, that's exactly how we came up with those topics, actually, was the advice that your mom gave you. These were the topics that you weren't supposed to talk about at the dinner table, basically. And these were the issues that needed the most talking if we were really going to get to a healthy place for not just our dinner table, but society, the larger dinner table, is that folks should feel comfortable enough to be able to say what's on their mind without feeling that they're going to be attacked, that they're going to be listened to.
Well, and I think people are actually desperate to talk about this stuff, and maybe I could throw in death and some other things as well. But just, you know, there's, I think, a really intense hunger, John, to have actual real conversations about this stuff.
I think that's true. What we have to also add to that mix, I think, is an attempt to have conversation with people who we will continue to get to know in a much more robust way. So I think part of the reason why, as the caller was saying, she experienced in Michigan, people would be so anxious about talking in mixed companies because they don't actually have relationships with people. And so as soon as you say something that someone doesn't like, or even if they might like it, they just aren't quite sure, they'll read you ungenerously. And you'll be at this weird stalemate. And I think that happens because we want to imagine that there's something about speaking itself that will solve all of our problems.
Yeah.
And communication isn't, again, we always say talk is cheap. It's cheap, I think, mostly because it can't end with that. And the reason why we can, I think, even imagine a scenario where people can get past that initial anxiety about whether or not they're going to offend people is if the people they might offend will be invested enough in their common cause that they'll be able to push back against that and continue to build a discussion that goes into operationalizing a social practice.
We have a comment from Clay in Philadelphia. Why are we always discussing the N-word and not other ethnic slurs? Why is it always a conversation about the N-word? I mean, I don't know if that's actually true or not, but do you think that word, John, is any more loaded than other racial slurs?
I mean, I think it probably is, but I also think there are other equivalents, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the key is it's a stand-in for all of the terms that we're afraid to talk about because we know they will offend people.
Right.
We can add more and more to them every day. But I think nigger is one of these words that, at least for the U.S. audience, is a real wonderful crystallization of all this history. But other terms can do the same thing.
Cora, I'm back to you and something else you wrote about, the sort of dreaded what are you question that you get asked. And this is, of course, about, you know, skin color and racial identity and heritage and genes and all of that. But that's a dreaded question for you.
Oh, I felt like we couldn't write a book without bringing up that question because it's the most impolite of questions to ask. And I was touched by the moment of reading John's essay when he felt in high school like he couldn't ask me that question because that's so impolite. And that was just how polite he was because everyone else asked that question.
Okay. Now you know, right?
But, you know, in that, you know, I felt in this moment, you know, in our discussions, about race, we're sort of in this moment where, you know, different terms like, you know, colorblind and multiracial and things are sort of the catchphrases of the day. And you know, I wanted to come out personally and feel like, well, you know, I don't really buy all that.
Right.
You know, to me, there isn't sort of these multiple boxes to check off. And I say that as someone who could check off multiple boxes. So, you know, it was a very personal, these are the boxes that I check and this is why I check it. And for me, just claiming, just one box, the blackness box is at this moment is, I feel even braver because it's, you know, we're at this moment where everyone is sort of, you know, rounding about and to sort of touch on your last caller's point about like why are we always talking about the N-word as opposed to other racial slurs. I think, you know, one of the differences was there was this that we can say N-word instead of the actual slur. But also it's who John and I are as writers. So, you know, we are even though the book is intended for everyone, you still have to write from your own voice. So, I'm writing as a black woman. And so that's the racial slur that gets hurled at me.
I hear you. We're almost out of time here. But, John, you wrote, all my best friends are light-skinned women. It was at a wedding or something and you realized.
Again, overly provocatively and somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, yeah.
But part of my point is to say, just remind us that skin color is still an issue. It's still something to think about, even though it feels very like passé and pre-civil rights era. You know what I mean? Like, and so it just so happened in my wedding party, and Cora was a part of my wedding party, there were a lot of women in the party who could have, quote unquote, passed for something other than black or potentially could have passed. So it would have been ambiguous. And my whole point is to say, you know, we often think about race in these very black or white, hard and fast terms. And it's always more ambiguous than that and more fungible. And the question of color and colorism within the black community, we don't talk about as much as we used to. Maybe they're bigger fish to fry, but it's still there. And it informs our assumptions about how race works and the logic of multiracial communities.
And I think when you're talking about colorism also, I mean, we need to broaden that conversation. We always talk about it within the black community. And now we are in a society where it's shades of brown that I think are mattering more. And when you're talking about immigration patterns and the racial discussions and ideas that people are bringing in, you know, from other borders, it's really the colorism, the shades of brown that are causing the casts.
On that note, we have to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. We could have gone, I think, on and on and on. There's much more to discuss. Thanks so much. And Cora, nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you back, John L. Jackson, Jr., and again, cultural anthropologist, filmmaker, dean of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. Cora Daniels is a contributing writer for Essence and their book called Impolite Conversations on Race, Politics, Sex, Money, and Religion. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can download a podcast of the show. You can also check us out on Twitter and Facebook, and you can listen to us on satellite radio. Quinn Lipson, the intern for Radio Times, Adam Staniszewski, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.